in our well-being, or in the people of Iran or the United or the American people in their own welfare and good. So, and that's the main issue. This is an imperialist aggression against the Iranian people. It's not against the regime. They want us to believe it's against the regime. It is against the people of Iran eventually. And history proves that. And we, in the anti-occupation, anti-genocide, peace movement in Israel, we know that it's very difficult now at the moment to take to the streets and to demonstrate because of the missiles and also because of the limitations posed by the government under the guise of emergency situation. But we know what is at stake. We know that the real interest of the governments are against the interest of the peoples, and we do whatever we can in order to protest and to stop this bloodshed.
So that was Ofer Kassif, member of the Israeli Knesset and the leftist Hadash-Tal party. He also was at the protest and says he was assaulted. Alon Lee Green, I want to thank you for being with us, co-director of the Israeli-Palestinian grassroots group Standing Together, organizer of Saturday's anti-war protest in Israel, arrested at the anti-war protest in Tel Aviv. He is now in court on another case. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Trita Parsi to talk about the war by Israel and the United States on Iran. Trita Parsi is Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Stay with us. And Thorns by Ahmet Ali Arslan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran enters its sixth week, President Trump has threatened to bomb Iran's power plants and bridges unless the Strait of Hormuz is reopened by Tuesday. Trump's attacks on civilian infrastructure would constitute war crimes under international law. In a profanity-laced Truth Social post on Easter Sunday, Trump wrote, quote, "Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one in Iran. There will be nothing like it." 3 exclamation points. "Open the effing strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah," the president wrote. He used the actual word. Iranian officials warned with retaliating, with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Naval Command saying in a post on X, the Strait of Hormuz, quote, "will never return to its former state, especially for America and Israel," unquote. Earlier this morning, Iranian media reported explosions after an Israeli attack on the South Pars petrochemical complex in the city of Azeulia. The South Pars is one of the world's largest natural gas reserves shared between Iran and Qatar, on the Persian Gulf. South Pars accounts for about 70% to 80% of Iran's gas supply. A separate U.S.-Israeli strike also targeted South Pars facilities in Iran last month. Meanwhile, Iranian state media reported today that Majid Khadami, intelligence chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, was killed in a joint U.S.-Israeli strike. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. We're certainly not seeing any triumph of diplomacy right now, Trita Parsi. If you can talk about President Trump's expletive-laced Easter Day message to Iran.
What we're seeing here is a repeat of previous threats and deadlines, but now, of course, with far greater tone of desperation from Trump. He has issued threats of this kind several times before. He hasn't fully acted on them, back down, recognizing that he doesn't have escalation dominance. He cannot escalate his way out of this conflict, because if he goes after the power plants on a large scale, the Iranians will do the same to the infrastructure in the GCC and Israel, and the situation will become much worse, particularly in terms of oil prices shooting up. Nevertheless, he is increasingly desperate because he's realizing he cannot just end the war by walking away. He has to have some sort of a negotiated settlement. But the negotiated settlement will be very different from the one that he first had in mind, because the realities on the ground are such that he is not in a dominant position. He cannot dictate terms. And as a result, now he's trying to issue these ultimatums in the hope that the Iranians will surrender. But there's no sign whatsoever that the Iranians are in the mood of a surrender or even accepting his deadline. The Iranians are not going to accept a ceasefire that puts them in the same position as Lebanon and Gaza have been put in when they have agreed to ceasefire by the United States and Israel, which have turned out to be just temporary pauses in order for the United States or Israel to be able to regroup, rearm, and then relaunch attacks. And this is clearly frustrating Trump, because he's realizing he's not in that position of dominance that he thought he would be in.
If you could talk about what the significance of South Pars right now, owned the north part run by Qatar, the south Iran, and of course, it is a major source of energy for Iran, like 70% to 80% of its energy, threatening to blow that up as well as bridges.
So South Pars is a very important field for the Iranians. It's shared. The gas field is shared with Qatar, although Qataris are extracting much more gas out of it because the Iranians don't have the technology, given all of the sanctions that have been imposed in Iran for a significant amount of time. Asadiyeh is another place nearby that is now being attacked currently by the Israelis, that is critical for Iran's domestic energy consumption. And we have seen that when those fields or facilities have been struck in the past, the Iranians have retaliated. It was when the Israelis attacked South Pars last time that the Iranians struck at these gas facilities inside of Qatar that set those back 3 to 5 years. It's very important to understand the difference here, in the sense that we have an oil problem right now because a lot of tankers are being stuck in the Persian Gulf. They cannot transit through, but the oil is still being extracted out of the ground. The infrastructure of oil has not been targeted on a large scale. If Trump escalates, then those will likely be targeted. And then you don't only have a bottleneck problem, you also have a production problem. The bottleneck problem can be resolved relatively quickly and oil prices can go down. But if you have a production problem, then that means that the production will not go up for quite some time. And that will create a much longer term problem on the oil markets. And that would be much, much worse than the current situation. So the Iranians have a lot of different ways that they can escalate matters further. Trump is aware of this, of course. This is part of the reason why he hasn't acted on a lot of his threats. But he seems to be getting increasingly desperate, and he may actually take steps that will be absolutely devastating for the global economy and for his own presidency.
Hmm. if you can respond to the Guardian just said, Iran confirms its received ceasefire plan, but says U.S. isn't ready for peace. The U.S., Iran, a group of regional mediators discussed the terms for a potential 45-day ceasefire that could lead to a permanent end to the war. And then you have Ali Abu Nima tweeting a few hours ago, U.S. is trying with Iran the same approaches with Gaza, phased agreements which the Americans and Israel will break and vague future arrangements to be hammered out in an indeterminate future. Your response?
Ali is absolutely right. This is the concern and the fear on the Iranian side that any type of a ceasefire would be to the benefit of the United States and Israel. They would not end the war. It would just be a tactical pause. In the meantime, the Iranians would be giving up a lot of their leverage, for instance, the control over the Straits. So I don't see any chance of that succeeding at all unless it is coupled with not this type of a phase approach, but there is actually a full agreement that includes sanctions relief and other measures. Now, the Iranian position, I think, in some ways have evolved and frankly hardened. The Straits is not necessarily a tool they will use for negotiations to end the war, but rather something that they will use after the war, the control of it, in order to establish this mechanism in which countries will have to pay transit fees to go through the Straits. And they will use that to restore economic relations with a lot of countries in the world that they used to have economic relations with, but who have essentially stopped dealing with Iran economically because of U.S. pressure. All of those countries, nevertheless, need access to the Straits, and the Iranians are essentially planning to use their control of the Straits to reestablish those economic relations rather than as a leverage to end the war.
Your response to President Trump telling Fox News the U.S., quote, sent a lot of guns to the Iranian protesters. We sent guns through the Kurds. I think the Kurds kept them, unquote.
So here's a very important revelation. We saw that during the protests in December and January that there were some things that were very, very different from the past. We saw that there were elements within the protest movement or acting underneath the protest movement that used massive amounts of violence, both against civilian infrastructure, mosques, banks, etc., fire stations, but also against government forces. That's why a lot of government forces were killed, which we have simply not seen before. These were armed elements. They operated in a rather professional and systematic way. And a lot of protesters, I spoke to some of the protesters who were out there genuinely protesting against the policies of the government, saw these forces and were quite stunned because they had never seen anything like that before. Now we have the revelation, which a lot of people suspected, but we have it from the horse's mouth, saying that the U.S. actually was providing weapons to the Kurds and other armed elements inside the country. This, I think, shows that the image we had originally, that this was just peaceful protesters clamped down by the government, was perhaps a bit simplistic. They were overwhelmingly peaceful protesters, but within them or underneath them, there were other elements that were using the protests to essentially start a violent conflict and uprising. That was clamped down together with a lot of peaceful protesters. The Iranian government seemed to have not made much of a distinction between the two and killed several thousand people. But it was a very different scenario from what you had in 2009, for instance, in which the protest movement was not only peaceful, but also ensure that it was not hijacked by violent elements. This time around, it seems like that was not a full possibility.
This is Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Ismail Baghi responding to Trump's threat to attack civilian infrastructure if the new deadline for Iran to open the Strait of Hormuz is not met.
Any such attack. Our armed forces have made it clear that in case Iran's infrastructure is attacked, we would react in kind. Our armed forces would target any similar infrastructure that is owned or in any way or manner related to the United States or contributes to their act of aggression against Iran. This is not something that we will do it voluntarily or by willful decision. This is something that is as part of our defense measures against their illegal act.
So that was the Iranian foreign ministry spokesperson, if you can respond to what he said, Trita Parsi.
So this is a continuation of what we've seen in the past, that the Iranians will retaliate in kind, but they will target the facilities that they have within their reach that are mainly in the GCC states, which then will be putting not only the GCC states in a terrible, terrible situation, but the entire global economy. We've seen that the Iranians have targeted American bases and other facilities, some of them civilian facilities in those countries. We have now also seen emerging evidence that many of these countries' territory and airspace was used by the United States to attack Iran. Now, whether those countries started allowing them to be used after the Iranians started attacking them, or whether those attacks were taking place from the outset, or whether those attacks from their airspace or territory is being conducted without the approval of these governments is unclear at this point. But the fact that the territory is being used in several cases, Kuwait, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, UAE, at this point is not quite clear. Evidence has emerged of that. And that's a very negative and dangerous development, particularly if it eventually leads to the Saudis and the Emiratis fully joining in on the war. That will be, again, we've already seen this conflict spread, but that will be a major, major escalation and will make it much more difficult to be able to bring this war to an end.
Can you talk about Iranian intelligence agents arresting the prominent human rights lawyer Nasrin Sotoudeh at her home, according to her daughter? She's 64 years old. Sotoudeh, renowned for defending activists, opposition politicians, and women prosecuted for removing their headscarves. Are you concerned about the possibility that if in prison, who knows by what side, could also be bombed, which of course is where so many dissidents are held?
We saw that in the June war that the Israelis did strike at the prison, whether they did so because they believed that that actually would be a beneficial act that would bring people out in the streets or protesting or put them on the side of being opposed to the repression of the Iranian government is unclear. But it really did backfire on the Israelis. Whether they would do it again remains to be seen. So far, they've been focused more on attacking pharmaceutical factories and also universities. But I think an important point that we're seeing here is that the Islamic Republic is being changed, but it is being changed in a much more hawkish direction. This is a direct consequence of this war that was illegally launched by Israel and the United States. It was also highly predictable that under these circumstances, the Iranian government would likely become more repressive and have more restrictions on the political space in the country. We've seen that pattern before. So rather than this being some sort of an effort that would bring about democracy in Iran, as some people apparently have thought, the track record was already very clear that the most likely outcome would be that we would see the most repressive and hawkish version of the Islamic Republic coming out of this war.
Tell us also, if you're able to communicate with people in Iran, the state imposed near total internet shutdown, now the longest nationwide blackout on record of any country.
It is very challenging, but I've managed to get through to quite a few people. It is not the same type of a blackout that we saw on January 8th till a couple of days in which the Iranians really shut down everything, jammed Starlink and everything else. It's not that level, but it is nevertheless extremely restrictive. And I don't see any likelihood of that opening up any as long as the war continues to go on.
Finally, are you concerned the U.S. or Israel would use a nuclear bomb against Iran?
So I've had conversations here in Washington, and I have been quite taken aback by seeing that a lot of former officials are very candid that this is an option on the table. It comes out of the fact that Trump appears to be increasingly desperate. He could end up going on bombing Iran for another 2 weeks, trying to achieve some major spectacle and then just walk away, knowing that he doesn't have the ability or the patience for the real diplomacy that is needed, doesn't have the willingness to give compromises. So he may just escalate it in a spectacular way and then walk away, leaving the straits in the control of the Iranians. And that could potentially include the use of a nuclear weapon. The fact that that actually is being discussed or is being contemplated and discussed by former officials as an option that Trump is looking at, or the Israelis are looking at, is telling us about how badly this war is going, how desperate the situation is becoming, and how tremendously, tremendously dangerous this would be for the entire world. As one former official told me, this would make the United States the absolutely most hated country in the world if it uses a nuclear weapon as a way of just demonstrating its military superiority.
Trita Parsi, thanks so much for being with us. Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. A number of books he's written, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Coming up, Israel has expanded evacuation orders in southern Lebanon and continues to bombard the country. 1 million displaced, over 1,400 dead, over 125 of them children. We'll go to Beirut. Stay with us.
Freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom.
We who believe in freedom.
We who believe cannot rest until it comes. We who believe.
We who believe,
we who believe,
oh, we who believe,
we who believe, we who believe.
Ella's song, We Who Believe in Freedom Cannot Rest Until It Comes, Sweet Honey in the Rock, performing at the 2025 Peace Ball. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli strikes across Lebanon Sunday killed at least 15 people as Israeli troops pushed deeper into southern Lebanon. Israel's ordered the expansion of its so-called buffer zone from the Latani River to areas north of the Zahrani River, displacing about one-fifth of Lebanon's population. Israel continues to bomb bridges across the Latani, isolating the southern region of Lebanon. Since Israel launched its war against Hezbollah on March 2nd, more than 1,400 people have been killed in Lebanon, including at least 126 children. This is Jamal Salim Faran, now homeless after Israeli strikes on Tyre left his neighborhood in ruins.
Someone who can barely afford their daily bread can't even buy a loaf, and then a plane comes and strikes? For what reason? Just because I'm sitting on my land? I will not leave. This is our land, and we will not give it up.
Beirut was pounded with airstrikes Friday as Israel claimed it was targeting militant infrastructure. For more, we go to Lebanon's capital to speak with Ramzi Kais, the Lebanon researcher for Human Rights Watch. Ramzi, you're back from the south of Lebanon. Israel's expanding its so-called buffer zone from the Latani River to the Zahrani River. Can you talk about the significance and what you saw and overall what's happening in Lebanon?
Thanks, Amy, and thanks for having me. As you noted, it's been over a month since the escalation between Israel and Hezbollah, and so far there's been over 1,460 people that have been killed in Lebanon. This includes over 130 children after yesterday's attacks, 54 medical workers, and Israeli military has ordered nearly 15% of Lebanon's territory to be evacuated through displacement orders that they've issued as early as March 4 to the area south of the Litani River, and then expanded that on March 12. But they have repeatedly reissued those same statements, essentially ordering people to be to leave those areas. And not only that, statements that have been issued by Israeli military officials and government officials, such as the defense ministers, have signaled an intent to commit more atrocities. Israel Katz, Israel's minister of defense, have said that he and Netanyahu have ordered the acceleration of destruction of homes along Lebanon's border, that they will be preventing hundreds of thousands of Shia residents from returning to their homes south of the Itani River, and that they could conduct as well strikes that could target civilians. This was mentioned in displacement orders issued for the southern suburbs of Beirut between March 11 and 15. More recently, bridges across the Litani River have been struck. The most of the bridges have been struck I was in the city of Sur or Tir last week, and residents, municipality officials, health workers, and hospital officials told us that essentially there's one lifeline left into the city and other areas south of the Litani that tens of thousands of people who remain south of the Litani River, despite these displacement orders, depend on. They depend on it for humanitarian supplies, going into those areas for medical supplies, for supplies needed for hospitals. And so with this signaled intent by the Israeli military officials to occupy the area south of the Litani River to prevent people from returning, we are seeing a humanitarian catastrophe unfold. And should the Qasimiyya bridge be struck as well, we're talking about tens of thousands of people being severed not only from the rest of the country but from access to supplies, humanitarian supplies, medical supplies that they need for their own survival.
And Israel's claims that it's targeting militant infrastructure, that it is fighting Hezbollah.
So the Israeli military has claimed that it has bombed the bridges because they are being used by Hezbollah. But there are also claims that they have, been striking healthcare workers because those vehicles are being used by Hezbollah. I think what we're seeing in this war, with particularly the large number of civilians being killed, health workers and journalists, there are many patterns that we've documented before. This is a war, again, that's been ongoing since October 2023. And over the past 2.5 years, we've documented repeated, apparently deliberate attacks on civilians. This includes journalists, it includes medical workers, it includes peacekeeping forces. We've documented a previously widespread use of white phosphorus, including unlawfully overpopulated residential areas, and the targeting of civilian objects, such as financial institutions and others. And what we're seeing now is what appears to be a continuation of that same pattern. But what's different, I think, this time around is that there's a new brazenness in the statements issued by Israeli military, where they are simply stating that they intend to commit more war crimes. They are stating that we will be preventing people, hundreds of thousands of people, from returning to their homes, that we will be destroying homes along the Lebanon border in order to establish a buffer zone, that we will not hesitate to strike anyone who is near Hezbollah facilities or equipment, which is a different tone that I think from what we've seen in the last war. And, perhaps a reflection of just the state of impunity for any violations that have been committed in Lebanon, as in Gaza, for the last 2.5 years, with no accountability whatsoever for violations of the laws of war.
Human Rights Watch has also written that Israel's displacement of civilians in Lebanon is a possible war crime. Ramzi.
Indeed. And the statements that have been issued by the Israeli military signal that, the displacement of civilians is not necessarily tied to their protection. They've specifically singled out Shia residents from the area south of Litani, saying that they will prevent their return in order until the safety of Israel's northern residents is guaranteed. And under international humanitarian law, forced displacement is prohibited, and people should be allowed to return to their homes as soon as the hostilities cease or as soon as the conditions for their displacement cease to exist. But what we're seeing instead is that the return of people, and particularly of Shia residents in southern Lebanon, is being tied to some vague, undefined safety standard in northern Israel.
Ramzi Qais, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Lebanon researcher at Human Rights Watch, speaking to us from Beirut, just back from southern Lebanon. Thank you so much. We will link to Human Rights Watch's reports. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for development associates. Support our fundraising team. Go to democracynow.org. And Democracy Now!, the film about it as we celebrate 30 years, is opening at the IFC Theater here in New York on Thursday. It's called Steal the Story, Please. I'll be doing the Q&A after the film with the film's directors, Carl Diehl and Tia Lesson, on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. It's also opening at the Jacob Burns Theater and at Huntington, where I'll be doing the Q&As there on Sunday and Tuesday. Tuesday, and then we head to Los Angeles, to the Lemley Theaters in Glendale and North Hollywood and more, and to San Francisco at the Roxy and beyond. Check our website at democracynow.org for all details. The film Steal This Story, please, and let your friends know. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Perptine, Augusta Messiah-Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
My name is Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of two young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do three key things. Pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators. Transition all existing programs to $10 a day. And plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to 10aday.ca to learn more.